All right, hello. You are tuned into Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show. Right now, I am joined by Murray Brewster, who is a correspondent for the Canadian Press. And he's just recently written a book, which will be in stores when you hear this interview, called The Savage War, looking at the Canadian mission in Afghanistan. Thank you very much for joining me, Murray.
You're welcome.
So now, today, October 7th, is the anniversary of the start of the NATO-led mission. So, 10 years of being in Afghanistan. So kind of just to start, after all these 10 years, I just want to kind of get your reflection on these 10 years and maybe some of the perhaps the faults, the successes of this mission over this 10-year period.
Well, it seems longer than 10 years. I have to give you that. I mean, I covered 9/11 in New York, and I was there for 2 weeks following the Twin Towers coming down, and it seems very much like another lifetime. Now, to speak to your question about our involvement in Afghanistan, essentially it began, I believe the federal government acknowledges our involvement as beginning on October the 10th, 2001. And I think that's because it was the day that ships set sail from Halifax to take part in the war on terror and be patrolling the Middle East, looking for Al-Qaeda suspects as the Americans launched it. Your question's really, really broad in terms of, what has worked and what hasn't. The Canadian military went into Kandahar in 2006 at the behest of the Canadian government, and I would suggest that while the Canadian military is among the best trained in the world and the best equipped, both the military and the government went in woefully unprepared into that part of the world. I don't think we necessarily understood what we were getting into. Now, given the way things have turned out, I'm sure some of your listeners are going to go, duh, yeah. But in the book, I try to explore the reasons for that. And one of the reasons that that I hit on is that we rely on American intelligence. And the American intelligence about Kandahar and about what we would face was wrong. And, you've had folks here in Ottawa say on a regular basis, well, we never expected Kandahar to be, to turn into the kind of mission that it has. And everyone around here, at least, has sort of accepted that explanation. And, oh, yeah, okay, no, nobody could say it. But my question is, why weren't you expecting it? Because when the Canadian military went into Kandahar, the defense minister at the time, Liberal defense minister Bill Graham, was going around the country and giving these rather, not sky is falling, but rather dark speeches about what we could potentially face there. And as it turns out, the speeches that he was giving in the fall of 2005 was what we ended up facing. And the Liberal government of the day was spent like over $250 million re-equipping the army just before the Kandahar mission, just before Paul Martin's government fell. Now, if that doesn't tell you that we were the country was sort of new in some respects, like was worried about what it was getting into. I don't know what I don't know what else, what other signs that we necessarily need. But in terms of what we didn't understand was we didn't understand the dynamics of the region. I don't think we really understood the Taliban or the enemy that the army was going to be asked to fight, and I don't think we necessarily understood the the extent to which society in Kandahar had been shredded by 30 years of war. And I don't think we necessarily understood basically how desperately poor entire region was, and that it was something beyond the capacity of the federal government to fix. So those are some of the things that that I found out. You asked about successes. I would suggest to you that the last 5.5 years in Kandahar has reinvented the Canadian Army, the Canadian military, because prior to 9/11 and prior to our involvement in Afghanistan, there was the sense that the Army were peacekeepers, and they were being equipped as such. And the world changed after 9/11, and the conflicts that we are going to face in the 21st century, many of them, are not going to be state-to-state conflicts, the kind of traditional, like, World War II type things that we faced, or even Korea for that matter. The kind of conflicts we're going to be, the military is going to be called upon to fight are the ones, is going to be very much like what we saw in Kandahar. So if I could call this a positive, I would say that it's brought the Canadian military and perhaps the Canadian foreign policy group here in Ottawa into the 21st century in a very brutal way.
Interesting. Now, talking a little bit more about how kind of underprepared and, maybe not seeing what the true situation that they would face in Afghanistan was, it's kind of interesting because it still kind of boggles my mind as to why they wouldn't, see that this is what you would have to deal with, like, even in terms of the dynamic of not even just the Taliban, but even the warlords, and
The information on the warlords was evident before we went in.
Mm-hmm. It seems that only for the last couple years do we start talking about that issue and how that dynamic plays out in Afghanistan.
That's true.
Because
that's when we just started to wrap our heads around it.
Yeah. Maybe talk a bit more about that. Like, how, though? How could that have happened? Like, is it just a matter of maybe some people in the higher intelligence community and military community knew about this, but, they wanted to keep it under wraps until they figured it out?
I think it's because of the way we structure how we gather intelligence. We are heavily dependent upon the Americans. And when I say heavily dependent, it's not only for the information gathering, the human intelligence, activities that both the Americans and the British would do, but also too in terms of the analytical capabilities, right? Because when intelligence, arrives in Ottawa from Washington or whatever, it's already been run through the analytical process there, so we have a tendency to go, oh, okay, well, the Americans have looked at this, and this is the way it must be, and et cetera, et cetera. And, in some respects, it proved to be a bit of a disaster in Kandahar, because the Americans, at the beginning of the mission, when the Taliban were moving in 2006 and, setting up their places and setting up their networks, et cetera, they kept, focusing the Canadian attention on the northern part of Kandahar, which is called Shawalikot, and they were saying, well, you got to go up here and sweep these areas, and you've got to be, fighting, and getting them, taking the Taliban on up there. Well, the Taliban weren't there. All of the mountain passes and the valleys, there would be, there were at least two or three operations in the spring of 2006 and even to the summer of 2006 that showed there was no Taliban there. Well, the Taliban were actually in the Zari and Panjwa district to the west of Kandahar. And that's where we were running into all the firefights. And, American intelligence got it wrong. And, maybe should we be surprised after the Iraq war and, the stunning lack of, judgment when it came to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq? We never stopped to question whether the information that we were getting was accurate or not. And I think that that's like that is really something that Canadians have to focus on, because, and even after we kept pointing out to the Americans in Kandahar in 2006 that we're getting into a lot of firefights in Zari and Panjwa districts, and the Americans go, oh, you're just nervous peacekeepers, right? You know, don't worry about that, right? You know, you guys have not fought a war in like 50 years, and I mean, the Canadian troops are very highly trained, and they're, you know, I would venture to say much more thoughtful than some of the Americans that I've had to deal with, and they were dismissed. The concerns were dismissed. So I really think that this is some of the things that we have to take a very, very hard look at.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking more about this dynamic in Afghanistan, it's very interesting because kind of at the start of the war, there was kind of this, I guess, this notion of, well, you know, we just got to go in there and we got to smoke them out. And that's kind of, you know, what we're here to do, right?
It was a counterterrorism operation. Mm-hmm. You're correct. That's right.
Yeah. And so, but it's interesting that as it went on, it kind of changed into more this, well, now we have to talk about, you know, reconstruction.
Yes, we have to love the people.
Right, but now the other part of that, though, is interesting because there's still this notion of this economic problems, like you talked about the poverty in Afghanistan. And it's kind of interesting when you tie that into the reconstruction efforts, because I've been reading that, you know, as far as everything that's being built, none of the, you know, Afghans don't get hired to help with the reconstruction effort. Can you speak to that, please?
Yes. Oh, yeah, I can. I mean, the reconstruction effort, in my estimation, was geared more towards long-term economic development rather than stabilizing a desperately poor country and a country that was, like, on the brink of anarchy. And the example I will give you is that the Canadian government in 2008 laid down a series of benchmarks, and you know, these are sort of the development goals that we have for Kandahar, and these are some of the signature projects that, you know, that we are going to, these are the things we're going to do for the Afghans. And, you know, one of them was the reconstruction of the Dala Dam, which would bring irrigation, you know, and repair the irrigation system, which was destroyed by the Soviets in the 1980s. We also promised to build 50 schools. We also promised, you know, to eradicate polio. And I would suggest to you that those are all very noble, laudable goals. They really are. But it was the kind of stuff that will bear fruit years down the road. You know, it wasn't the sort of stuff that, the visible demonstration that Afghans needed to see immediately to instill confidence not only in their own government but in the international military effort in that region. And the example that I will give you is one that stuck in my craw for at least 2 or 3 years, was the fact that there was no stable, and there still isn't really, stable electricity in Kandahar City. It's on, the power's on for like 2 hours a day. And, you know, that has a whole host of ramifications, including the fact that businesses can't open. They can't employ people. And, you know, the unemployment rate in Afghanistan, the official rate, I mean, I honestly don't know how they calculate it in that kind of country, but the official unemployment rate in Afghanistan, when we went into Kandahar in 2006, was 43%. Like, I just want to pause on that figure for a moment. 43%. Anyway, we're complaining about 7.6, you know. But after 5.5 years and billions of dollars, the unemployment rate nationally in Afghanistan is 41%. So, you know, I can remember sitting in the living room of the head of the Kandahar Industrial Association, their version of the Chamber of Commerce, I guess is the best way to put it. And the gentleman's name is Haji Kwasim. Very nice man, speaks very good English, and very smart businessman. And, you know, he told me, he said, if we had stable electricity, we could put 6,400 people to work tomorrow. And he leaned forward and he looked like right in my face and said, that's 6,400 people that wouldn't be shooting at you if you can give them a job.
Hmm.
And he was right. So a lot of the development effort was focused on very noble, laudable, long-term goals. And there was no sense of, and no urgency, either here in Ottawa or in Kabul at some of the centers, of actually doing things to stabilize things quickly. When we did try to do it, it was small, little projects here and there, small, little things, like paying Afghan workers to clear irrigation canals or something like that for, like, seasonal work, you know. And that's the best way to describe it, I guess. And that's where I think that we had, you know, one of the failures of this mission.
Mm-hmm. Now, in talking about this dynamic, like we were talking a bit before about the dynamic with the warlords and even how the Taliban, how it operates, kind of, you know, because I've heard, well, Jeremy Scahill, who's an investigative journalist, talked about this issue, as well as Scott Taylor from Esprit de Corps, about, you know, going in and killing some of these old guard kind of guys in the Taliban, wherein they're replaced by even more extremist elements.
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about that? Because I find that interesting, because, you know, I think Scahill and Jeremy Scahill and Scott Taylor both said, you know, you're killing these people, but maybe they're not the best people, but at the very least you can reason with them.
Well, it really comes down to an individual assessment. I mean, mm-hmm. some people are more reasonable than others, right? Aspects of the Taliban insurgency, yeah, you can talk to. And there was a policy, a Canadian and an American policy, of, no, we don't talk to the Taliban. And that went on for years. Right, it went on for years. No, we don't negotiate, and it's not only did we not want to negotiate, because the excuse was this is something that the Afghan government needs to solve. Well, okay, fair enough. But then you support the Afghan government behind the scenes to try and get them to be talking reconciliation, and rather than encouraging reconciliation, we were discouraging reconciliation behind the scenes. In terms of individual warlords, I would suggest to you that Scott and some of the other analysts who have looked at this are correct, because the assassination campaign that was carried out by NATO forces was wildly successful. I mean, they were very good in terms of the counterterrorism operation that eliminated a lot of mid-level and top-level Taliban commanders. But yes, the effect of that assassination campaign was to replace them with even more hardline elements. And one of the things I talk about in the book as an example is how the assassination campaign was so successful. At one point, there was a power vacuum in southern Afghanistan in late 2008, early 2009. And during that time, there were more extreme elements that came in and started training local Taliban in Kandahar in better IED techniques, in better ambush techniques. And and it made the war more deadly, for Canadian soldiers. The other aspect of the warlordism is the politics of it, and how Canadians and Americans in the West largely come into Afghanistan preaching democracy and justice and fairness for all and economic development and the Afghans, individual people on the street, embrace that wholeheartedly when we first when the West first came in. But some of the people that that we, the Canadians and the Americans, ended up allying ourselves with had very spotty, you know, very, very spotty human rights records. And, you know, we were perceived as, in some respects, propping up these corrupt, you know, individuals who would, you know, impose these shadow taxes. For example, the former governor of Kandahar, Asadullah Khalid, you know, imposed this 20% shadow tax on things and made himself absolutely filthy, stinking rich by doing so. And he did so under our watch. Hmm. And that led to resentment from, you know, local Afghans. And so when, you know, you see it from both ends, right? You see the assassination campaign essentially radicalizing the Taliban even more, and then, but at the same time, you see ordinary people being alienated because, you know, because of the support for some of these local warlords.
Hmm. Right. Well, I mean, that's talk about opening up a can of worms, right?
Pandora's box.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. We will have to leave it there, Murray. But thank you very much for giving your time and your analysis on this, you know, very, very important issue, really. So for the listeners, could you just maybe talk a little bit about your book and kind of where they can get it?
Sure. The book is called The Savage War. It will be in stores over the next few days, and you should be able to get it at all Chapters locations and in most bookstores. You can also order it online right now at Amazon.ca.
Excellent, Murray. Well, thank you so much again.
You're welcome.
Yeah, have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.